Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about the experience of Black Americans in the USA in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War and the effect that the war had had on them socially, culturally, politically, and in terms of the civil rights struggle. Now, it's the view of James Patterson, author of Grand Expectations, the chapter of the Oxford History of the United States that runs from 1945 to 74, that by 1945, the condition of life in America for Black Americans on average had improved. This was in part due to the war and in part due to long-term economic changes happening in the Deep South, where the majority of Black people had lived since the end of slavery in 1865. The South had been mechanized, or the cotton industry in the South had been mechanized by the early 1940s, which meant that large numbers of farm labourers were unemployed, and this was part of the explanation as to why there was a huge migration during the Second World War from south to north. This has obviously already happened once during the First World War, but the number of people moving, and there were a large number of white people that moved as well, from south to north, created this dramatic, dramatic demographic shift. During the 1950s, another 1.5 million Black people would leave the South to join family members already in the North and to escape the poverty and the increased violence that accompanied the intensifying civil rights struggle. And in general, Black Americans began to be economically occupied far more in industry than in agriculture. The numbers of Black Americans who wound up working in agriculture between 1939 and 1945 increased by 700,000. Starting in 1939, 500,000 or thereabouts Black Americans were involved in manufacturing, and by the end of the war, it's 1.2 million. The number of women who worked as domestic servants, dramatically declined as well. 72% of Black women in 1939 worked in service, 48% did at the end of the war. And that in itself has something to do with new opportunities opening up for Black American women, but it's also got to do with a change in expectations. This highly unattractive role, highly servile role, which was only ever really carried out by Black American women as a necessity, not as a desirable employment at all, suddenly goes into nosedive during the war because there are obviously other options. Amongst the professions, amongst the white collar roles, Black people by the late 1940s are starting to make a very small appearance. In 1944, for example, the normally white-dominated press corps around the White House sees a black reporter for the first time admitted. And in 1947, there were black journalists who were allowed into the Senate press gallery. Not to suggest that there weren't black journalists prior to this, there was a rich and thriving journalism, black journalism, in places like Pittsburgh, in places like Harlem, and some of the most interesting and better read newspapers of the period, the Pittsburgh Courier being the classic example, contributed immensely to black American society, to American culture, and to a sense of black American community and politics. In part, it was a patient civil rights work done during the Second World War which had led to some of these achievements. A. Philip Randolph, who was the head of the Sleeping Car Porters Union, in 1941 had threatened a march on Washington, and he was, in 1963, one of the principal organisers of the famous March on Washington, which resulted in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. The March on Washington was a threat to the federal government to act against discrimination in the army and in public contracted employment, i.e. the arms industry and war production. There were notable examples of strikes in shipyards in Georgia where black workers demanded the same rights as white workers, i.e. the same access to skilled employment, better paid skilled employment, and training on jobs such as welding and electrics and that kind of thing. White trade unions liked to ensure that their members had a monopoly on the best types of work, skilled work, that was better paid. Roosevelt, who certainly doesn't need industrial unrest in America during a war being fought against a racist fascist power, industrial unrest based on racial discrimination, issues an executive order as preventing discrimination in the war production industries, and establishes the Fair Employment Practices Commission to enforce this order. There is wide evasion of the order, as employers and workers, white employers and workers, that is, found all sorts of strategies and tactics to get round it and to keep black workers in their place. And the fact that this was the case, the fact that there was an effort to undermine presidential orders at a time of war, a war that can be interpreted as a struggle for national survival, goes on to show you the deep importance that white privileged elites in labour and industry attached to discrimination, to ensuring that skilled black labour didn't emerge within the workforce. In areas where there was high competition between white workers and lower paid black workers, the idea of white soldiers returning home from the war to find a skilled black competition for their jobs was utterly unpalatable to the existing racist hierarchy. This is not just in the southern states either, unless we kind of target them to the exclusion of everywhere else. And it would have presented an existential challenge to white control of the economy, which had been the underpinning of discrimination since 1865. There seemed little point in prevailing over Nazism, Italian fascism, and Japanese imperialism if one was to be defeated on the home front, so the thinking went. But it was these kinds of struggles during the war that led to a more militant kind of black activism emerging. I say militant is nothing on the scale of and the level of activism in the late 60s, early 70s, but certainly there was a greater sense of organisation and purpose that the war, the conditions of the war, kind of engender. The activism of Philip Randolph led to the Pittsburgh Courier demanding the Double V campaign, victory over fascism and imperialism abroad and over racism at home. The war, in the eyes of many black political activists, had presented them with an historic opportunity, as wars very often do, to reshape the political and the social landscape in order to bring about progressive change. One activist, Roy Wilkins, an NAACP leader, wrote in 1942 to one of his contemporaries, "It is a plain fact that no Negro leader with a constituency can face his members today and ask for full support for the war in light of the atmosphere the government has created." So the NAACP was only really as strong and as willing to be compromising as its membership would allow. And a new sense of determination amongst black people and a new sense of anger and resentment about the treatment of black people manifested itself in the membership of things like the NAACP. In 1935, it had a membership of 50,000, and by 1945, it had a membership of nearly 10 times that, of 450,000. In 1944, the sociologist Gunnar Myrdal wrote an influential text on discrimination and racism in America, called it An American Dilemma. The book was a wide-reaching study of race relations in America, and he thought in it that the dilemma in question stemmed from a paradox within American history, that the conflict between the forces of democracy and equality and the entrenched force of racial injustice in America would meet each other at an uncompromising impasse. Myrdal was by and large optimistic about America, about the Constitution and the institutions that governed America, and believed that these would have the power to overcome prejudice. He said that black Americans had changed. He said that they could no longer be thought of as a patient, submissive majority. They will continue to become less well accommodated. A lot of this is kind of quite antiquated and sort of slightly patronising, dare you say, even slightly offensive language that was based in the assumptions of the time. Whilst Myrdal was able to see that the black community in America had become more politicised and more active, the idea of the patient, submissive Negro, in inverted commas, that had always existed in the imaginations of privileged white Americans was clearly still there. Myrdal was correct in his prediction that white people would oppose change, not all, obviously. He said that the white man can humiliate the Negro, he can thwart his ambitions, he can starve him. But white people, in Myrdal's view, did not have the moral stamina to make the Negro's subjugation legal and approved by society.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Against that stands not only the Constitution and the laws which could be changed, but also the American Creed, which is firmly rooted in the Americans' hearts. Now, actually, whilst a lot of this is kind of quite romantic and, shall we say, slightly unscientific language, these are the sorts of things that Martin Luther King actually believed. He thought that Christianity, liberal democracy, and the creed of freedom that seems to run through all American discourses and ideas about American identity would prevail, and that white Americans, when presented with the reality through the new medium of television in the 1950s, of discrimination in the South, of dogs being set on school children, of burning buses, would see this ugly truth as being completely incompatible with the way in which they like to conceive of the USA itself as a noble mission in the world. And this would be the key to bringing about fundamental change. And much of what Martin Luther King does is try to have a conversation with white America, and this is partly why he effectively cloaks his rhetoric in highly biblical terms. I mean, obviously he's a church minister, but he knows that the sort of language that he selects is highly effective in presenting a kind of a case of Christian morality to the rest of the United States. Myerdal was wrong in some respects. He didn't realise how entrenched white racism was and how difficult a institution, a concept, a kind of a cultural affiliation it was, would be to shift. The immense power of white racism in the South was going to persist, and arguably, not arguably, actually still does. The book also is littered with a variety of unpleasant stereotypes and out-and-out racist observations. For example, in practically all its divergences, American Negro culture is not something independent of general American culture. It is a distorted development or a pathological condition of the general American culture. The idea, therefore, that Myerdal was putting forward was that the subculture, as he saw it, of black American life was a divergence from a proper Americanness, and that proper Americanness, which was white Americanness, would at some point obviously have to intervene and correct the situation, and you know, in a paternalist manner, to raise the condition of the Negro. He said, "It is to the advantage of American Negroes as individuals and as a group to become assimilated into American culture, to acquire the traits held in esteem by the by dominant white Americans." And this is obviously how black Americans would be able to pursue the American dream, by really shedding themselves of their blackness and becoming like white people. I mean, the level of ignorance that statement has in order to kind of has to have in order to perpetuate itself. To us here in the 21st century, I guess it's quite breathtaking, but it is at the time written by an educated member of the intellectual elite, somebody who exists within the academy, and somebody who viewed this as being ultimately a peer-reviewed bit of social science. And so what we're looking at here really are the dominant assumptions, not of the racist South, but of liberal white America. So where liberal white America was kind of starting from was Gunnar Myrdal, and that sort of direction of thinking. So even the supposed allies of the civil rights movement amongst liberal white people, there were still all sorts of entrenched prejudices. This book was given unsparing praise throughout much of the 1940s, and it was only until there were more precise political dissections of it in the 1960s that it really starts to be discredited. W.B. Du Bois said of it, "It was a monumental and unrivaled study." Black Americans had distinguished themselves in the armed services during the war. 1 in 10 Americans were black, but 16% of the army was black. And 1 million black soldiers had fought between 1942 and 45. I say soldiers, obviously sailors and airmen as well. The Navy had only taken on, say, black sailors to serve as mess attendants and in other menial roles. It was Dory Miller, a black American mess attendant, who had taken to the anti-aircraft guns, I think, on the USS West Virginia at Pearl Harbor, and was decorated later for his bravery, though sadly he died a year or so later in the war. The army took in black private soldiers but refused to train them to the level of officer. It was assumed that they were either cowardly or lazy or ill-disciplined or whatever other ignorant racist stereotype one could attach to military service, and they thought that black soldiers wouldn't fight under fire. The Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, said that blacks should serve under white officers because leadership is not embedded in the Negro race yet, and today to make commissioned officers lead men into battle, coloured men, is only a work of disaster to both. Even in the politicians that didn't identify themselves with racist views, this term yet is always there, that, well, at some point in the future, surely black Americans would change, then culturally and politically and socially black Americans would change, and they would one day be at a level of education and discipline, that kind of thing, where they can do these things. But right now, it's not a good idea. And the only thing that distinguishes them between them and the extreme racist segregationists of the South is this word yet. It's the racist segregationists in the South who would argue, and in no point in the future is this possible or likely or desirable. And the yets in the North and the federal government are the ones who will say, well, at some point in the future, but the idea, there's no specific date at which this will actually occur. 1944 is the kind of the key year of change on this topic. The army, desperate for manpower during the Battle of the Bulge, began to use black soldiers and in an absolute crisis, and started to see that they actually were extremely good at fighting. The Navy began to integrate units, and I think in the Pacific there were black American Marines by 1944. General George Marshall was quoted as saying, "My God, my God, I don't know what to do about this race question in the army. I tell you frankly, it's the worst thing we have to deal with. We're getting a situation on our hands that may explode right in our faces." The idea of desegregating the army was politically impossible at the time, though Truman manages it by 1948. But it had ceased to be a situation that could be ignored and swept under the carpet. And again, this shows you what World War does in terms of the development of political pressures for change. And there is a classic quote from a black American corporal from the South, who said in 1945, when he was demobilised, "I spent 4 years in the army to free a bunch of Dutchmen and Frenchmen. I am hanged if I'm going to let the Alabama version of the Germans kick me around when I get home. No, sorry, Bob. I went into the army a nigger, and I'm coming out a man." And when you imagine that 70% of black people in the South lived in poverty by 1945, that the world that America had won by 1945, where 50% of the world's wealth came to 5% of the world's population, and 70% of black Americans still lived in poverty in 1945 in the South, there could be no justification, no argument, no logic other than the existence of discrimination to explain that. The world in which black Americans existed was segregated. Public places, beaches, trains, waiting rooms, restaurants, hotels, restrooms, drinking fountains, schools, churches, parks, beaches, every aspect of life outside the home was in some way segregated, and the black American experience was one of inferiority. And this, in the minds of white Southerners, and many white Northerners as well, was simply the nature of the world. This is simply a logic that black and white Americans were entitled to superiority. James Eastland, the Mississippi senator who became a leading light of white racism, expressed this when he made a wartime speech against the Federal Employment Practices Commission. He said, "What the people of this country must realise is the white race is a superior race and the Negro race is an inferior race." To which Myerdal added, "Southern whites do not see the handwriting on the wall. They do not study the impending changes. They live again in the pathetic illusion that the matter is settled. They do not care to have any constructive policies to meet the trends." So this is fascinating. White Americans at the end of the Second World War, Southern white Americans particularly, believed that the world of racial discrimination was a fixed one, despite having lived through some of the most titanic changes that human beings had ever seen, from the dropping of the atomic bomb particularly. The idea that black Americans were unlikely to challenge their situation because a natural order already existed, this was simply common sense in the South. Now, if you look at that as a starting point from understanding the civil rights struggle, then everything else you look at, from the Montgomery boycott all the way through to the Greensboro counter-protests and Selma, well, it makes a lot more sense, the way in which white Americans responded to these challenges. The order of the world as they understood it to be was being upturned, and they must do everything to struggle against it. Okay, well, I hope you found that useful, and I hope to be dipping in more to the civil rights movement in the near future. If you can give us a good write-up on iTunes, that would be terrific. And a review as well. And also, if it's possible, check on our Patreon page, and if you can make a donation, be much obliged. Thanks very much. Catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.